Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Hey folks, Jim Hansen from Black5.net and BigPeace.com. I'm sitting in for Frank today, and we're going to do some Secure Freedom Radio. Now, what I want to talk about today in the first segment is our overall posture in what used to be known as the War on Terror. You know, I'm not, up on what the latest euphemism is, whether we're still chasing man-caused disasters or whatever ridiculous way we're trying to pretend we're not in a war of cultures and a clash of civilizations. But we are. That's the bottom line. And our enemies, well, they take the long view. Our problem, we take the short view. We take the 24/7 news cycle view. We take the next election view. And we run our strategy as if it was a day-to-day thing. And that's been our problem as long as I can remember. And I want to talk a little bit about what that is causing right now in both our active war zones, which I guess right now is three. I don't know. Can anybody correct me on that? I think it's Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya. But I could be wrong. You know, it's a pretty fluid environment we're operating in. But let's start with Iraq. There was a report came out yesterday on Fox News that said that the Obama administration was considering a drawdown to 3,000 troops in Iraq. Not 30,000, 3,000. That's outrageous. And I think, honestly, my opinion is that that was probably a trial balloon floated by Obama and his team. And this is the military pushing back. You know, the sources quoted from Fox were military officials familiar with the planning. And I got a feeling that Obama and his team said, hey, look, you know, we need to make some points, score some points with the left. We've got a reelection coming up. You know, Obama's back to the one job he's actually good at. He's not much of a commander-in-chief. Guy's a pretty outstanding campaigner-in-chief. So now that he's back to his real job, I think this was an attempt to see just how far they could push the military. And I think they found out. The idea of leaving at this point simply 3,000 troops in Iraq, barely enough to conduct a training mission, not nearly enough to conduct any kind of security operations. Well, that was one of those things they did just to see if they could gain another talking point for the campaign trail. The nice thing is, it caused a legitimate amount of outrage from anybody who understands the situation over there. And I got a feeling, given his official liar, Carney, denying it, the Pentagon spokesman denying it, and everyone else, I think the decision has been made that that was outrageous. But it really doesn't change the fact that we're leaving Iraq as quickly as they can get away with. And the bottom line is, we're doing the same thing in Afghanistan. You know, the surge there was over, the faux surge, you know, the surge where you announce we're going to send some troops, but you make sure that everybody knows what the date on their return ticket is, and you tell our enemy, basically, if you can outlast us for 18 months, we'll be gone, and you can have the battlefield again. So we're in the same boat there. We've told our enemy we're leaving, and we have no strategic plan to follow on. And I just wonder, and we're going to talk with a couple of folks who can give some answers to this, but I wonder what that tells our enemies. And some of the guests who will be discussing that later in the show are Bill Raggio, who runs the Long War Journal, definitely one of the best analysts as far as both our military intelligence operations and our enemy, the Islamist extremists, terrorists of other flavors, and basically someone who can give us some insight as to what we're doing there. And also J.D. Johannes, who operates the Outside the Wire website. J.D. is a former Marine, now a combat correspondent, video documentarian, and someone who generally does not bother to sugarcoat anything. Love talking to J.D. So we'll get their thoughts on what the implications of our lack of resolve are in not just the active battle zones, but in the minds of our enemy, in their plans, and in the result of that around the world. Now, I think, obviously, we're not far from the 10th anniversary of 9/11. Another thing we're going to discuss is what Al-Qaeda is up to. Who is Al-Qaeda these days? You know, I mean, bin Laden's dead. Doesn't that mean the war is over? Doesn't that mean that Obama can tack a mission accomplished banner on the, you know, in the Rose Garden outside the White House and basically declare victory. He seems to have tried. You know, he spent an awful lot of time spiking the football and dancing around like he was the baddest man in the world, making the gutsiest call in the history of presidential commanding. And the bottom line is, I just got to let you know, I'm sorry, Barry, but wasn't that big a deal. You know, the second we had a location on bin Laden, making the call to take him out was probably the easiest call for a president to make. The tough call now is, what do we do about the rest of al-Qaeda? It's not like bin Laden was the be-all, end-all. Yeah, it's great to have a figurehead to go ahead and say, if we take this guy out, we've killed an organization, but we haven't. To call them Hydra-headed would be an understatement. You know, we've played whack-a-mole all over Pakistan and Afghanistan, and to some extent in Yemen, Somalia, and other areas where the Islamists have been operating, and we've killed any number of their leaders. And yet, their organizations spread. They gather territory. They reform, regroup, refit, recruit, and then send their troops back out to cause us trouble any place they can. So the bottom line is, we don't have a plan. What we have is a withdrawal. And it's not even really a strategic withdrawal. We're pulling ourselves off the battlefield and out of the war, and we have done nothing to basically put anybody in place or put anything in place that's going to allow us to maintain the hard-fought gains we have. Iraq right now is still a violent and dangerous place. It's not like the Iranians next door have stopped their efforts to influence that area. They believe they should be dominant in the region. They're not going to stop for a second just because we need to withdraw our troops to satisfy domestic constituencies of the Democrats and to satisfy those who have an actual, and I would say in some cases, legitimate war weariness. All right. Just because we're a little tired doesn't mean the bad guys are going to stop their efforts, and they haven't. So we're pulling out of Iraq. We're pulling out of Afghanistan, and our enemy is expanding into both of those areas and into every other place where there is weak central government and Islamic mentality and opportunity. They take the opportunity. We take the opportunity to go ahead and make sure that our officials get reelected. So it's a situation where I think the problems are not getting easier. The solutions are tougher, and the will doesn't seem to be there. So what we're going to discuss basically is what the situation is. Let's figure out the current state. What does al-Qaeda comprise right now? You know, they're an affiliate-based organization at this point. They're really a brand. You know, I'm going to ask these gentlemen whether al-Qaeda is an actual central organization or whether any group of, you know, like-minded Islamist extremists can put it together and slap the terrorist equivalent of the Golden Arches on it, you know, and become an al-Qaeda affiliate and take their terror to the world. It sure seems like that's the case. And if so, what is our strategy against that? What are we doing to combat that? I mean, if it is a clash of civilizations, if it is a battle for free Western civilization versus repressive Islamists who are trying to restore a caliphate, what are we doing to stop that? I'm unaware of anything, you know, and I know that's a theme Frank and his guests regularly discuss. We don't have a plan that deals with the underlying issues. We have decided that as long as we can whack a few moles, as long as we can get some headlines in the newspapers that say, today we killed al-Qaeda's number two in Afghanistan. Yeah, how many times did we kill al-Qaeda's number two in Iraq? You know, I lost count over the years. That used to be the least safe position of anywhere in the world, was to be the number two guy in al-Qaeda. And if you were the number three, you darn sure had some vertical mobility, because number two guy was going to eat a hellfire at some point in time. So we're in the same boat now. You know, yeah, we can occasionally locate some of their leaders. We can generally send something flying down out of the sky to scatter them, return them to room temperature, you know, and stack them like cordwood. But we don't gain intelligence because we're not capturing them. We don't have a long-term plan to counter their ideology. We don't have an information plan that shows anyone in those areas why we are a better alternative, why freedom is better than oppression. And in the end, we have nothing but a collection of band-aids put on the same gaping chest wound over and over and over again. We fought the same battle in Afghanistan 10 times in a row. We go there for a year, We replace the units that are there, and boom. Next year, the same guys, or a collection of new guys, are trying to fight the same battles from the year before. So all in all, we've got an awful lot of challenges on our plate, and from what I can see, we don't have anything vaguely approaching a coherent strategy to combat them. So that's what today's Secure Freedom Radio is going to discuss with our guests, J.D. Johannes from OutsideTheWire.com and Mr. Bill Raggio of the Long War Journal. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney with Secure Freedom Radio.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
My name is Sunday Hollis, and I totally lost the cravings for sweets. I totally lost the cravings for bread, even meat. And some people, you know, you would see people say, oh, well, you're eating a salad because you're trying to diet, but you just don't have a taste for any of the junk anymore. And it is so, so, so true. I'm thinking this is something that the celebrities are using. They're just not giving the meta system the credit for it. I've tried everything under the sun, and this is the only product that I have even called the company and asked them, could I sell it for them? This is a product where you can actually use the word awesome. I mean, and it is the whole essence of the word awesome.
Don't wait another minute to start losing weight. Call Judy Singer's The Meta System at 1-800-711-JUDY. That's 1-800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
To halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Hey, folks, Jim Hansen sitting in for Mr. Gaffney, who is keeping the world safe in the southern hemisphere these days. Listen, I have on the phone right now Mr. Bill Raggio, proprietor of the Long War Journal. I like to talk with Bill because, obviously, as evidenced by the name of his site, he takes the long view. He takes the view that we are in not a politically driven 24/7 news cycle fight, but we are in an actual clash of cultures. We are in a battle against an enemy who thinks in terms of centuries and millenniums, not in terms of the next election cycle. What I want to do is have a discussion with you, Bill, about the actual terrorist threat and what's going on these days. But first, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jim. Always a pleasure.
I guess there's been a lot of talk these days about what the actual implications of bin Laden's death were on al-Qaeda, but I think that really misses the larger point. I think it was obvious that bin Laden was marginalized, and I'd like to start with your thoughts as to what is the future of al-Qaeda look like, absent of bin Laden and absent, from our perspective, a real focus on our war against them?
Yeah, you know, look, bin Laden's death is certainly an important victory in this long war, but it's not the end of al-Qaeda as it's been advertised. I think al-Qaeda's been planning for his death. I also don't believe that he was as marginalized as been advertised. Documents have shown that he's been involved in planning of attacks and whatnot. But the reality is that Al-Qaeda is an organization that's always has been bigger than bin Laden. Definitely a major key player in the organization, one of the founders and the key ideologue. But Al-Qaeda has grown in the last 10 years since 9/11. It's spawned affiliates throughout the Middle East and North Africa and South Asia. It's still capable of conducting attacks, and it's taken over territory in Pakistan, in areas of Afghanistan, Somalia, Yemen. What we're watching in Yemen now is the Al-Qaeda takeover of southern Yemen. And, you know, it has a strong affiliate in North Africa, a suicide attack there just a week or so ago. You know, we're looking at an organization that is resilient and that is bigger than Al-Qaeda. And a lot of American officials are touting the deaths of several Al-Qaeda leaders since bin Laden was killed in that daring raid in Abbottabad in Pakistan. But even those deaths haven't been confirmed. Elias Kashmir is thought to have been killed in a Predator strike, as he's the head of Al-Qaeda's military, but that was never actually confirmed. Al-Qaeda hasn't announced it. The U.S. believes that he's dead based on some signals intelligence and some bad reporting from the region. And Atiyah Abdul Rahman, who's said to be Al-Qaeda's number two, but that's not accurate. That's actually Saif al-Adel. But Atiyah, a very important figure in Al-Qaeda. He served as bin Laden's chief of staff, basically, and a key operational leader. But his death hasn't been confirmed. And as a matter of fact, Al-Qaeda released a Ramadan tape from him that was apparently recorded before he was reported killed. But I've never seen Al-Qaeda do something like this, where they release a tape by someone before declaring them dead. So to get to the bigger point of Al-Qaeda and whether it's on the ropes, as a lot of officials want to say, I just don't think that's accurate when you look at what Al-Qaeda has done to establish safe havens in areas where it didn't have safe havens just years ago. And again, Somalia and Yemen being two big areas recently. Shabab, Al-Qaeda's affiliate there, controls, even though they've done a tactical withdrawal from large areas of Mogadishu, still controls much of southern Somalia and central Somalia. And Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is actually beating the Yemeni army and taking over cities and towns throughout the southern Yemen.
Let me ask you something, though, Bill. Obviously, I think these gains are not terrifying, but they're worrisome in a huge way. But let me ask you, how coherent an organization is Al-Qaeda? I mean, we always hear about the franchise model. Any terrorist group that pops up and has a good, you know, repressive Islamist mentality can slap the Al-Qaeda label on, and then we throw them in with the larger group we call Al-Qaeda. But how coherent an organization are they as far as command and control, planning, and these other things? Is this one organization, or is it just a more loose collection of like-minded terrorist bastards?
I think it's something in between. I mean, Al-Qaeda has a central command that's able to direct global plots, but it provides key support to establishing these affiliates. And key members of these affiliates were senior leaders in Al-Qaeda's global commands. For instance, in Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Nasir al-Wahashi was Osama bin Laden's basically his aide-de-camp for a long time before going to the Arabian Peninsula and establishing Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula there. Key leaders of Shabab, Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Somalia, or were former members of Al-Qaeda's senior leadership. Some have been killed over time. But, you know, I think that the assumption that's made, and it's been made since the very beginning of this war, is, well, look, if we just kill some key leaders, then Al-Qaeda is finished. But Al-Qaeda has a deep bench in itself. It's built, these affiliates provide leadership, provide members that can rise through the ranks, not only of the local affiliates, but through the ranks of Al-Qaeda. T. Abdul Rahman, for instance, he was a member of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. You know, and you go on and on. Elias Kashmiri, he was a member of the Harkat al-Jihad-e-Islami, a Pakistani terror group that was supported by the Pakistani state. He rose to lead Al-Qaeda's military. That's that deep bench that Al-Qaeda has. It draws on its affiliates to staff its central command, and then it uses that staff in the central command to farm out leadership to its affiliates. It's sort of this is what Al-Qaeda is. This is what bin Laden has wanted to establish. I think he's been successful in this. Al-Qaeda central command, it's taken some blows through the Predator strikes in North Waziristan, no doubt. But Al-Qaeda isn't just based in North and South Waziristan and Pakistan's tribal areas. As we see with the arrest of a senior leader, Yunus al-Maritani, just last week in Quetta in Pakistan, Al-Qaeda's, or bin Laden being killed in Abbottabad, their leadership core isn't just based in a small area where we could pick them off with predators. They're networked throughout Pakistan, and then they have these other areas where their leaders can go. And these other safe havens allow Al-Qaeda to keep leaders out of those free fire zones in North and South Waziristan. U.S. is expanding efforts in Yemen and Somalia. We're conducting covert strikes there and special operations raids there. But the reality is at the end of the day, Al-Qaeda still controls territory in these areas. We could kill leaders, but they control turf. And with controlling turf, they can tax, they can recruit, they could control, and you use that turf to run training camps to carry out attacks against the West.
Folks, we're talking with Bill Raggio, an intelligence analyst and basically an expert on terrorist operations around the world and our response to those. He operates the Long War Journal. Bill, I guess when you discuss the idea that even within Pakistan, you know, Al-Qaeda's leadership is dispersed. Obviously, you know, with bin Laden and Abbottabad, obviously the Quetta Shura and any number of other places where the ISI, Pakistan's intelligence service, has kept relations with Al-Qaeda and with the Taliban leadership. How strong do you think, you know, given the current situation, how strong do you think the ties are between the ISI and Al-Qaeda as opposed to the ISI and the Taliban? Obviously, they're very tight with the Taliban. What is their level of interaction with Al-Qaeda inside of Pakistan?
Look, I think that the fact that bin Laden was based in Abbottabad, just miles outside of their West Point there. And this is not just, some city like here in the West. This is a city where there's checkpoints, multiple checkpoints to get in and out of the city. You don't just move in and out. I think the fact that bin Laden was based there tells you that, well, the ISI, and this gets really difficult, Jim, because the ISI itself isn't a homogenous organization. There's parts of the ISI that dislikes Al-Qaeda. There's parts that are ambivalent, and then there's parts that support it. But I think with bin Laden being in Abbottabad, that tells us the ISI either turned the other way and pretended it didn't know, or there were elements of it that were actually supporting. And I believe that it's a combination of those two. The ISI isn't a huge fan of Al-Qaeda itself. It's far more close to the Taliban and these Pakistani terror groups that it spawned. As we've seen, the ISI, or Pakistani military, has been willing to round up Al-Qaeda operatives when it suits their need. There was particularly a lot of pressure after 9/11. That's how we got Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and it's a slew of other senior Al-Qaeda leaders. But then the detention of top Al-Qaeda leaders stopped sometime after 2005, and the U.S. began conducting predator strikes. This arrest of Yunus al-Martani, who was basically one of Al-Qaeda's top leaders of their external operations council, they're the ones that are designed to hit us here. You know, this is one of the first arrests that we've seen from the Pakistani military, and it comes at a time when U.S.-Pakistan relations are low, so a lot of theory going on there that, well, this is just an attempt by the Pakistan to curry favor. But Pakistan is far closer to the Taliban and to these terror groups like Laskhar-e-Taiba, Jaish-e-Mohammed, Houthi, all these other groups that it spawned to conduct jihad in both Afghanistan and in Kashmir against India. But the reality is that, you know, the Pakistan tries to play these games of separation. Well, we don't really like Al-Qaeda, but Lashkar-e-Taiba is okay. Well, the reality is Lashkar-e-Taiba is a very close ally to Al-Qaeda. It provides that deep bench. It shares the same strategic goals as Al-Qaeda, et cetera, et cetera. And so the Pakistanis, it's really difficult when you want to discuss how Pakistan's involvement in this. But at best, it's sort of a turn a blind eye to this, and at worst, it's sometimes some tacit support for it as well.
Right on. I'd like to explore a little bit further, Bill, how Al-Qaeda has branched out and how strong these actual other affiliates are. We'll be back right after the break with Mr. Bill Raggio of the Long War Journal.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it. At www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fastballing philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
What are you doing?
Filling out a loan application.
I can help you get approved, you know.
Really? How?
With this.
A bag of sand?
It's not a bag. It's a pouch. And it's not sand. It's credit fairy dust.
Credit fairy dust?
Yes. I sprinkle some fairy dust on the application, and your credit rating magically improves.
There's no such thing as the credit fairy.
An unbeliever now. But what will you think when your loan is approved?
I'll think my credit score improved because I paid my bills on time, kept my credit card balances low, and only opened a new card if I really needed it.
It's the dust.
It's sand.
Don't deny the credit fairy.
There's no magic to improving your credit, but there is help, and it's free. Go to creditfairy.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the Consumer Bankers Foundation, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights Education Fund, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Hey, folks, it's Jim Hansen from Black5.net and BigPeace.com sitting in for Frank, talking this segment again with Mr. Bill Raggio of the Long War Journal. And we're discussing Al-Qaeda's operations globally and going to kind of lead that into our efforts against them. Bill, it seemed you mentioned that there was a recent capture by the Pakistani military of a Mauritanian terrorist leader of Al-Qaeda. What and that was done by the Pakistani military, but what has the change in our mentality from attempting to capture Al-Qaeda leaders, interrogate them, roll up their networks that way, to more of the, I would almost call it the whack-a-mole predator concept where, okay, if they pop their head up, we send them a Hellfire missile for a present, but we don't end up then, I don't believe, gaining as much intelligence. What's your impression of our overall counter-terror efforts as it relates to a kill versus capture mentality?
Yeah, Jim, I think you hit the nail right on the head. I mean, there is... the U.S. is just not capturing terrorists like it used to. The problems of detaining them, of what to do with them, has created such an issue. It's such a political issue that the U.S. has decided, well, look, we want to try and close down Guantanamo Bay, and let's just go and kill them. So, and you've seen this in reports in the New York Times, Washington Post, you know, the CIA and Joint Special Operations Command. Look at the Bin Laden raid. I mean, it was essentially a kill mission. This is exactly what we're doing, not just in Pakistan, but in Yemen, in Somalia. We've shifted from attempting to capture leaders to gain intelligence just to let's try and kill them. And yeah, you're absolutely correct. This really harms the intelligence cycle over time. We've gained a lot of knowledge based on Al-Qaeda, based on interrogations of Al-Qaeda leaders captured in the early stages of the war. And that intelligence is going to dry up at some point, because when you kill someone, and particularly when you do it with a predator strike, you know, the bin Laden raid was a little exceptional. You know, while they did kill bin Laden, they went in and the special operations forces seized a lot of documents and intelligence that can be used. But every time you capture a predator strike in northwestern Pakistan or in Yemen or in Somalia, you're not getting that individual. You can't conduct an interrogation, or you can't even seize documents or other materials, because all you're doing is blowing something up.
Right, you got no site exploitation. You got no ability to gather the media, because even these guys, you know, at their most paranoid, they're still communicating, they're still using electronic means, and they're still keeping some kind of records, and we get none of that.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely correct. And, you know, even trying to confirm whether these people have been killed is spotty at best. And I mentioned two examples with Kashmiri and Atiyah Abdullah Rahman. We think we killed them based on some intelligence intercepts. Well, that's all well and good, but we've had intelligence intercepts that Kashmiri was killed in 2010, 2009. We've had intelligence intercepts that Atiyah was killed in 2010. I could go down I could create a list here of senior Al-Qaeda, Taliban, and other allied terrorist leaders that we thought we killed, where the Pakistanis thought we killed, and who later, you know, wound up being alive. Haki Mullah Masood, for instance, the leader of the Pakistani Taliban. Everybody said he was dead in early 2010. I was the only one saying he was alive based on the reporting. There was just no evidence that he was indeed killed. And what happened on May 1st? You had the attempted Times Square bombing, and Haki Mullah comes out and sticks his finger in her eye and claims the attack and says, yep, I'm alive, and you were all wrong. That's, you know, so we're overly reliant on signals intelligence and remote control killing. I'm all for, you know, that's fine. We could kill them. That's not a bad idea.
I love the doing the dead tangos dance, and I think it's brilliant. But I think the larger point is, why have we lost the will to capture these people? I mean, is it a question of the Obama administration at this point? Now, you say this stopped in, say, 2005 and 6. Is it pressure about interrogations and Guantanamo and all these public issues that should have remained in private in the shadows affecting our will to capture and interrogate these terrorists?
Well, the major captures in Pakistan stopped in around 2005, 2006. However, you know, the only places we are actually exploiting intelligence are places where we're on the ground, Afghanistan and Iraq, right? There's where we're doing the real captures, because then we could transfer those detainees over to the local governments at some point. But we don't have that advantage in Pakistan, Somalia, and Yemen. I mean, you can't turn anyone over to the Yemenis. They just, it's a revolving door there. It's difficult to know exactly when the will to actually capture and this turnover to kill them began. But it does seem to coincide when the Obama administration took power in Washington. And so, you know, and we know this administration does not want to deal with issues like Guantanamo Bay. It does not want to, it fears backlash from holding terrorists without trying them. So, you know, the Bush administration was willing to defend Guantanamo. This administration is not. And I think that's ultimately what it comes down to, is that, you know, the this should have been clear when President Obama, you know, on his first day, you know, signed the order to close Guantanamo, which, by the way, can't even do.
Yeah, how's that going for him?
And that just shows you how dangerous these guys are. And we have a recidivism rate of somewhere around 20%, and I'm told it could be even higher. That's just what we know. That's what we can either confirm or have very strong suspect that these guys are back in the fight. We just killed a Guantanamo recidivist in Nangarhar province in Afghanistan just a couple of days ago in an airstrike. I mean, our policy concerning terrorist detainees is messed up, to say the least. And, you know, I think it started from the beginning. There never was a sit down between the major agencies and Congress. Congress has abdicated its authority on this. No, everybody has tried to punt it. What the Bush administration did was said, fine, we'll set up Gitmo, we'll detain them, we'll interrogate them there, and we'll conduct military trials. But politically, that was not sustainable over time. And now you have what you have. And basically,
you know, They never took the time, though, to actually run a trial, convict some guys, and either execute them or sentence them. I think that's a problem. Folks, we're talking with Bill Raggio, who runs the Long War Journal at longwarjournal.org, one of my favorite sources as far as the actions of our enemies around the world, and also a good eye on how we have been prosecuting, you know, our efforts against them. Now, looking at the fact that we don't seem to have the will or the ability or any, you know, any actions we take to capture and coordinate our efforts against this, how are we then going to, as you mentioned, in Yemen, in Somalia, in these other places where they're now consolidating, how are we going to have any effect on terrorist operations there short of occasionally, you know, dropping a hellfire on somebody?
Well, we believe that we could partner up with local security forces in the case of Yemen. Bad idea in the case of Somalia. With who is the question?
Yeah, who is the
and
number?
Leverage signals intelligence and other remote controlled gathered information. And that's how we're conducting a lot of our targeting. Sure, there are efforts to do some ground intelligence. But again, the focus, I think a large focus of this war, it's a fetishization of the predators, of the drones that's existed. And President Biden has said, or Vice President Biden has said, you know,
yeah, bite your tongue.
Way
there.
To go. Yes. and I think we've seen, you know, that this is the way the administration has gone with that. It's safe. It doesn't put troops at risk. It looks clean. I mean, I think the entire irony that it's more humane to kill someone than it is to detain them for indefinitely. I mean, nobody ever asked the question of why is that okay?
Where is the rationalization for not even bothering to give somebody any due process? I mean, last time I checked, the Hellfire does not serve a subpoena before it returns somebody to their component molecule.
Right, yeah, exactly. And look, as far as what is torture? I mean, I think some of the claims of what happened in particularly in black sites, Guantanamo saw very little, quote unquote, torture. But, you know, we should have those debates. Those are issues that we should discuss as Americans. You know, how they should be detained, how we should conduct a trial. We should definitely have those discussions. They should be done reasonably. I mean, we've never had a reasonable discussion about those. But at the end of the day, we need to recognize we're at war with a group that is looking to fight us for decades, and it's absolutely crazy to release soldiers back on the battlefield while a war is still ongoing. But yet that's exactly what we're doing at this point in time. We're either deciding, well, we'll catch and release them, but it detain just a few indefinitely, or we'll kill them in predator strikes. I mean, that's really what it's kind of, and I realize that's an oversimplification of what's going on, but that's essentially what is going on.
Yeah, no, I wish it was not, Bill, but unfortunately that is exactly what our policy has been. Folks, this has been Bill Raggio, who runs longwarjournal.org, a tremendous source of information on the war on terror. Thanks for checking in with us, Bill, and next segment we'll be talking with J.D. Johannes about his recent trip to Afghanistan. It's Jim Hansen with Secure Freedom Radio.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy to eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful, all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff. Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Real. What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, folks, Jim Hansen back with some more Secure Freedom Radio. I am sitting in for Frank, who is down in South America, keeping that part of the world safe for democracy. Joining me right now is J.D. Johannes, who is a videographer and combat correspondent, recently returned from Afghanistan. You can find his reports and his website and his previous work at OutsideTheWire.com. I highly commend it to you. Welcome to the show, J.D.
Hey, great to be here, Jim.
Now, I mentioned when we talked just previously that you had just come back from the Hindu Kush, and you corrected me. Where is the correct way to phrase where you were?
Well, I was in host province, so that would be the Sulaiman Mountain Ridge. The Hindu Kush that everybody talks about is actually the northern mountains. That would be up around Bamiyan and the Salong Pass region is the Hindu Kush. And I spent a significant amount of time where there are no mountains, and that would be Helmand Province. It's just a whole bunch of poppy fields.
There we go, and we know the significance
of them. Poppy fields and minefields.
Yeah, what a lovely combination, huh?
Well, you walk through there, and we went on a mission with the Marines, and all you can see, I mean, literally for miles, is just green poppy, and all you can think is, oh, my gosh, look at all this H.
You know, but now think about it. Does that let you know, though, because of the value of the poppies, there are less likely to be mines in the poppy fields, right?
No.
No? See, there you go. There's a false assumption I would have made.
No, because, you know, they're going to put mines wherever they think the Marines are going to be. And Marines, they're not going to walk on roads, they're not going to walk on trails, they're going to walk through the minefield. So then the whole place is just, they can be anywhere and everywhere. And in the Argandab River Valley, west of Kandahar, it is just absurd. I mean, there is just no such thing as a place where there could not be a landmine or some kind of a booby trap. You know, their favorite place is, they know when it gets hot outside, soldiers go looking for shade when they got a minute or two that they can rest. So where do they start putting it? Under trees, in trees, walls that you would lean against, place where you'd go to provide cover, a secure corner, any place like that, there could be a mine. There could be a mine or a booby trap or an IED.
Wow, what a lovely vacation spot you went to. Now, obviously, you weren't there for your, you know, relaxation, but give us a little bit of a feel for what you saw and an impression, both from our troops' perspective and your own, as to what's coming up down the pike, what's going on there, and what's coming next.
You know, I was there through the summer, hit there in April, and just got back here in early August. And the big question early on is, you know, how long is the surge going to last? How long is the surge going to last? What's the president going to do? And I kept telling the staff NCOs and officers who had asked me, I said, well, the president's going to do what will get him reelected. That's what politicians do. Big surprise. And so we see now with the surge being ended and with drawdown happening, there was really a lot of wind that came out of the sails. The Marines were pushing it hard, real hard down in Helmand Province. In the Argandab Valley, they surged into an area. They put five maneuver battalions shoved into a small area, you know, truly doing it Anbar style, you know, small outposts, living in the villages. And if you needed to move through the minefields to push further south to the rivers, like, okay, we're just going to take out the bulldozers and plow ourselves a new field. There's a lot of momentum in those big surge areas. And even where I spend the bulk of my time, 2 months up in Host Province, which would be east central Afghanistan along the Pakistan border, as soon as that announcement was made, it was kind of like, we're not going to be able to see this thing through, are we? And it took a lot of the wind out of the sails. And I wouldn't say that, you know, it was like, oh, well, let's give up, let's throw in the towel. But you could almost feel a shift in the psychological momentum to, you know, the acknowledgement that, yeah, we can push as hard as we can, but the follow-up isn't going to be here because when we rotate out, we're not going to get replaced by another brigade. We're going to be replaced by Battalion Plus.
So, I mean, now, you mentioned, obviously, our guys are always going to drive on and continue with their mission.
They are,
I mean,
going,
that's what
to
we do.
Push, they're going to push it 100%. They're going to push it as hard as they can. The question then becomes, okay, what do you do that is the most sustainable path from here, knowing that, you know, if you're a battalion commander, odds are your area could just be replaced with a company. If you're a brigade commander, you're going to be replaced by two battalions.
But, I mean, is the expectation then that the Afghan security forces are going to take up that slack? I mean, and is there any possibility they can do that?
Two-part answer. The expectation is that, yes, they are going to take up the slack, and everything's supposed to be geared towards transition at this stage. How do we transition them into lead taking control 100% of security? That is the plan. Second part of your question is, can the accomplishment? I don't think so. And it's not because Afghans are inherently incompetent. It's because it has been a learned incompetence. We have set them up as a mirror image of ourselves rather than a mirror image of the enemy that they need to defeat. And so once we pull out helicopters, logistics, supplies, and everything that we do so incredibly well, they're not going to be trained up and experienced with just how to go hunting people down on their own, doing very intensive population-centric counterinsurgency.
Right. Folks, we're talking with J.D. Johannes. Please go to his website. It's outsidethewire.com. He recently returned from another trip to Afghanistan after numerous trips to Iraq. He's one of my favorite combat correspondents. J.D., then, given the fact that we're pulling out, there's no question, we're pulling out of Iraq, we're pulling out of Afghanistan, we're done. I mean, we're pretty much done at this point with our active war fighting. What does that tell our enemies?
It tells, you know, that is the most important signal question that is still hanging out there. And in all through the debate over what, you know, what the drawdown should look like, should we draw down or not, should we end the surge, keep going with the surge in Afghanistan, no one has looked at what are the outcomes and weighing it against the outcomes. We're just weighing it against the current. Where we stand right now, is this worth it or not? Now, we can tell how this thing ends in Afghanistan. We, you know, we've already seen how this one ends. It was called 1989-1990 with the Soviets. We know how this thing's going to play out in Afghanistan. What is the signal then to the larger competition throughout the world? The United States doesn't have the stomach for the long fight, can't keep it up. The United States is broke, vulnerable, weak. There's a lot of signals being sent by everything that we do that'll have implications down the road.
Vietnam Redux? I mean, come on. The Soviets expanded a lot during the Cold War times because we had lost the will to oppose them actively. Are we doing the same thing with the Islamists?
Yes, but there's a weird factor we got to throw in with the Islamists. They've got a huge amount of territory in play now all across North Africa and the Levant there in the Middle East, that'd be Mediterranean region there in the Middle East, and into Arabia. There's so much flux and turmoil going on there. The question is, are they going to focus internally on what they can achieve there in their own in the Maghreb, their own areas there, the Islamic areas, or are they going to take a track where they can focus on an external enemy to rally the troops and rally the base? Now, focusing on an external enemy, this sort of plays into Afghanistan. Historically, the people who have been able to unite Afghanistan as a country have focused on an external enemy. Islam, external enemy. It's a proven course of action for them. So we're going to see in Afghanistan after the drawdown is we're going to see Warlordistan fire up, and whoever can unify the people around Islam one and then focus them on an external enemy, that's who's going to rally the troops in Afghanistan. Whoever can pull that off in a lot of other countries in the Middle East and North Africa is going to be the emergence. And that's the big fear then with what happens to greater Islam.
Well, JD, I think you outlined the challenge for us, because we have obviously been that external enemy for a lot of folks over the years, and the question now is, with us no longer being involved in the active war fighting, what will become of the Islamists left standing? And there's unfortunately too many of them. Folks, that's going to wrap up this edition of Secure Freedom Radio. Look forward to talking with you folks again, and we appreciate your listening and staying informed. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney.
Find out who Frank is interviewing in advance at his Facebook site, facebook.com/securefreedom. From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.